It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, Ja Parrish and Maria Tomczyk, co-editors at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
We get overtime for this, don't we?
You're getting twice what you normally get.
Let me see. 2 times 0 equals...
Carry the zero. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Yes, likewise.
All right. And I appreciate
and,
you coming
to our,
this morning.
And to our listeners
yes,
also.
Yes, yes. Hope they are having a...
both of them.
Happy holiday. Thanks for tuning in, Mom.
Anyone who's not sleeping in.
Yeah.
All right.
Or been dragged to the tree by their kids.
Mm-hmm.
So, the Washington State saga for who's going to be our next governor continues this week. And taking things to the courts.
Before we get into talking about the news this week.
Speaking of counting.
Right. We were going to, you know, after people have already been, you know, solicited to come and buy, shop, and spend their money on Christmas gifts.
And get ready for the after Christmas sales.
Yeah. I know those 7 a.m. store opening.
So we have a very, very small window here to work with.
Yeah. We were going to solicit you for donations for this program for Eat the State. Now, we do a fun drive twice a year. That's our new policy now. And folks should know that we don't get paid anything to do either the radio show or to put together the newspaper. And we pretty much subsist on donations from our readers and the little bit of money that comes in for subscriptions. So we want to remind people that this time of year, when you're thinking about taking out your checkbook and donating to various causes, think of us first, if you can. And send us some money to help us put out Eat the State and keep the radio show going and keep good stuff coming.
Or a subscription. It's what is it now? $24 for 1 year, $45 for two.
I thought it was $25, but
$25. Okay.
you can go to our website.
It's on the website. You can actually even subscribe there via PayPal.
Mm-hmm.
Or donate.
And the website is www.eatthestate.org. If you want to just write us a check and drop it in the mail, what is our address?
P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145. And we'll repeat that again at the end of the show.
Okay.
Yeah, the subscriptions are a great idea, especially for those of you just waking up today, realizing what day it is, and maybe you haven't gotten presents for everybody yet, so... you can go in confident knowing that you can tell them that, arranged for you to get a subscription to Eat the State.
Yeah, and if that's the case, then you probably want something that increases the level of information in your life.
Yeah, it's also perfect for those family gatherings where you see the uncle you see, you know, once a year because you can't stand his politics and you end up in a fight with them. You can always come home and take this information you've written down and send him a subscription to Eat the State so that he gets a little better idea, gets a little bit prepared for his next bout at Christmas.
Yeah, either that or he won't be speaking to you at all next year. That's,
yeah.
That's the other alternative to how that could work
and
out.
And for some people, that might be preferable.
All right, so moving along to the events of the week, the battle between Christine Gregoire and Dino Rossi, our two fabulous choices for governor, continues to be hammered out.
Yeah, I want to go the way the mayoral race in San Diego went, where they've now got a third candidate who was a write-in in the election where they've discovered all sorts of votes for. That's the other big national electoral drama that's going on, but... looks like Christine Gregoire will be our governor now. This is not over. People should not be under any hint of idea that this might be over anytime soon. Probably what will happen at this point is it will go to the courts. The Republican Party and Chris Vance are going to make the case that the votes should not have been counted, and what we'll wind up with, in all probability, is a jury trial in which both sides will be able to trot out their evidence of why their person should be governor, and a judge and jury will be the ones who decide who our next governor is. That's likely to be what will play out as the various challenges and court cases are heard over the next few weeks.
And the fight will probably be not over additional ballots that are discovered or over Rossi has talked about taking the taking the state to court or various counties to court, forcing them to count ballots that were thrown out because signatures couldn't be verified, etc. It's probably going to be fought over these ballots that were discovered in King County, and the bulk of which were for Christine Gregoire. It'll be interesting to see what the ruling is on those.
Yeah, although bear in mind that that Gregoire had pulled ahead even before the King County votes were cast. Mm-hmm. She pulled ahead on the basis of Pearson Snohomish County votes the previous day.
Yeah.
That's when she was ahead by like 10 votes or some minuscule amount. So so both sides are going to be dragging out the you know, their contested ballots, and
yeah.
And the lawyers will be the ones getting rich off of it. In the meantime, poor Gary Locke, who does not want to stay in office, and not many other people want him to stay in office either, but he's stuck there by the terms of the state constitution until a new governor can be selected.
Yeah, and other options like having a runoff election, et cetera, those appear to be very, very dim
yeah.
prospects at this point.
They could be ordered by a court, but it's highly unlikely that it would be at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what Ralph Monroe and I are pushing, is the revote.
Yeah. I actually mentioned that last week too. I thought it was a good idea, and it is, but it's not likely to happen.
I think it set a great precedent, and that's probably exactly why they won't go for it.
Yeah. Well, it also makes a lot of sense, and that's why they won't go
right,
for it either.
Right.
There's too much at stake for either side, where they have more trust in their lawyers than they do in the electorate.
It'll also be expensive. I mean, not just in terms of what it costs to hold the election, but also what it costs for the candidates to continue campaigning. That's another reason why they're not going to be for doing a runoff election. I think another interesting solution we kind of joked about before the show started was we could have them share the job. You know, Chris Gregoire could be our governor on Saturdays, and Dino Rossi could be our governor on Sundays, and for the other 5 days of the week, we could be blissfully without a governor.
Yeah, just hold a vacant seat. I think that'd be a fine idea.
Yeah. Or they could both concede. We could be completely without a governor. That would be kind of nice.
Or you have to have a runoff, but you have to have different candidates this time.
That's right.
That would be another possibility.
You have to include anyone who wants to run.
All right, so kind of like,
careful, we'll get Schwarzenegger.
I was going to say, it sounds like California.
Who's our big personality here? That might we'll get Chris Novoselic. He'll be our new governor.
Yeah, that would be an improvement, actually.
Yeah, I don't think that would be too bad.
All right.
I mean, because there isn't a whole lot of difference between Gregoire and Rossi. I don't see why they can't share the job.
So, jumping over to other elections in other countries, what's happening in the Ukraine?
Election revote that we talked about there is a model for what could happen in this country, hint, hint, wink, wink, is happening tomorrow. A lot of election observers are on hand from different parts of the world for this time, and Yushchenko, the challenger who lost out last time through fraudulent voting, is widely expected to win this time. But the saga does not end there, because Yanukovych, who was declared the winner last time, but was sort of victimized by the whole Orange Revolution movement and the massive demonstrations in the streets, is threatening to mount demonstrations with his own supporters this time. And he's the Moscow-backed candidate that has been widely discredited by the movement that's taken place there over the last month and a half. So it's a case that the election tomorrow will probably go Yushchenko's way at this point,
barring any further ingestion of dioxin.
Yeah, assuming he's alive by this time tomorrow.
Yeah.
We haven't we assume he has somebody to check his soup these days.
Yeah,
but.
yeah, but they're lining up for that job.
Fortunately, that isn't something that is carried over into our electoral politics yet.
Not that we know of, anyway. Yeah,
it's not that we're aware of.
All right. So, anything else on that?
Otherwise,
we're
just flag it.
We are over then to This Week in Iraq.
This Week in Iraq.
The main headline this week was the attack on the mess tent in Mosul, and the explosion that killed 14 American soldiers and 8 other people. Now, at first, it appeared obvious to me, probably not to other people who were reading the reports of the first reports that came out about this explosion. It was obvious to me that it was probably not a rocket or a mortar, because if there was the possibility that a rocket or a mortar could destroy a mess tent at a U.S. base in Mosul, then it probably would have happened long ago, since U.S. bases have been under frequent, almost daily, mortar and rocket attacks all over the country. I was under the assumption that most of these places are located out of the range of mortar and rocket attack from outside the periphery of the camps. And so it was interesting to see the initial headlines. Some of them said explosion killed in mess tent kills 14, you know, or 24 people. Others said mortar or rocket killed, rocket explosion killed 22, 24 people. However, it was a matter of hours in some cases, only a couple of hours, in other cases a few more hours, before I saw reports coming out saying Pentagon and military are investigating whether a rocket or mortar hit the mess tent. And I thought, okay, if a rocket didn't hit and a mortar didn't hit, what caused the explosion? Well, obviously, it's not going to be a car bomb because no cars are allowed on the base, on U.S. military bases unless they are U.S. military vehicles. So it would have to be a suicide bomber. And lo and behold, a couple of days later, we finally get the reports. Yes, it was a suicide bomber. And then just yesterday, a further report that said the suicide bomber was likely to have been wearing an Iraqi military uniform. Now, this is something that the Pentagon wasn't going to release right away, even though they might have suspected it or known it right away. It's kind of an exercise in Pentagon damage control and what kind of information and how they sort of let it trickle out to the media so that days after the actual event, you finally find out the full story.
Yeah, there's also a report in this morning's Guardian newspaper in Britain that says there was a U.S. military report prior to the bombing a month ago that talked about the security failures around Mosul and that they were vulnerable to exactly this kind of attack. It didn't specify this attack by name there, this particular kind of attack by name, but it said that the insurgents were operating by and large at will, that there were a lot of security breaches at the base, and something like this was begging to happen.
Yeah, and that they had drawn down the number of soldiers deployed in Mosul, yet they were still required to try to maintain the same amount of security in that area, and that it was only a matter of time before something like this could happen.
Yeah, which begs the question all over again of why we don't get this in American media.
That's right, why you have to go to the British papers to read it. Now, given that that was the big headline here in the U.S., there were a lot of other, I think, bigger stories than just the death of a few U.S. soldiers in Iraq, something that happens every week over in that war. One of the big stories that did not make the headlines much here in the U.S. was that for the first time, a major U.S. contractor has pulled out of Iraq just in the past week. The company, Contract International is the name of the company, had a $325 million contract to rebuild roads, bridges, and other transport infrastructure in the country. The reason they withdrew, according to the president of their company, and this is a direct quote, he said, "We reached a point where our costs were getting prohibitive. We felt we were not serving the government and that the dollars were not being spent smartly." Now, when he says costs, he really means security costs, which for some of their projects were up to 60% of the money that was spent on the projects was for security. Now, their construction sites were under regular small arms and mortar fire. One of their drivers was kidnapped and killed, and their headquarters in Baghdad was attacked just a couple of months ago. So this gives you some idea of what kind of security problems they were encountering. Also, they said they couldn't get materials that they needed to do their construction work because Iraqi businesses were afraid to supply American companies, you know, because of the threat of retribution from the insurgents. Now, Contract International has received $30 million in the past 8 months, but what were they able to achieve for that $30 million? All they were able to complete was a bit of refurbishing work on a few train depots. That's the only thing they could get done for $30 million. The company president said, quote, it would have been a crime to spend that kind of money to do the type of work that they were doing. Now, meanwhile, Halliburton subsidiary Kellogg Brown and Root is continuing to accept has received some $10 billion in contracts to supply U.S. soldiers and to do work on the Iraqi oil fields. They're not complaining about the amount of money that they're spending on security. In fact, I believe they're pocketing a lot of it. because, as we know, the security around the Iraqi oil fields has been pretty low enough that the insurgents can do regular attacks on Iraqi oil pipelines, oil infrastructure, and even
pretty much with impunity.
Yeah, and even as they did in the last week, they blew up a major oil hub that supplies oil to Baghdad and cities in the north, as well as for the export, the northern export pipeline. So you would think, you know, places like that would be heavily guarded, that there would be some kind of effort to protect the Iraqi oil supply if we're spending that kind of money paying a company like Kellogg Brown and Root. But in fact, I think a lot of that money is going into somebody's pocket.
Yeah, and logistically, it's very difficult to guard a pipeline, because you're literally talking about guarding miles upon miles upon miles of pipeline, and you just can't guard all points at all times.
Yeah, and obviously they're not even guarding the junctions, the places where pipelines intersect, where one explosion can damage not just one pipeline, but can damage five or six, because that's what happened in the last week. An explosion went off at a major junction, and it damaged some five or six pipelines. That you would think they would have under guard.
Yeah.
Well, no. Anyway, to move on, another of the big headlines this week was that the first 1,000 Iraqis have been able to return to a neighborhood of Fallujah. The U.S. military had said, well, we're going to start letting the heads of households trickle back into the city, and they can resettle and start rebuilding their city, et cetera, all of that glowing and optimistic language. What happened is, among those first 1,000 Iraqi men who returned to Fallujah, a large number of them, and you can read this in the British press, you won't read this in the American press, a large number of them told reporters, what can we do? Our houses are destroyed. This city is not even fit for dogs to live in, not even fit for animals to live in. And that's not surprising, given that the Red Cross has said that there is no water supply, there is no electric supply to any part of the city, and they just recently got the sewage pumps operating again. So at least they can get rid of some of the sewage in the city, but everything else is an absolute mess. And at the same time, I should mention that the U.S. military has been heavily bombing Fallujah again, that the effort to pacify that city has not been successful,
because the fighting continues. Three more soldiers died there yesterday.
Yeah. And how are we doing for time?
We're fine. We're 10 minutes.
Okay. So I want to just talk about one more headline out of Iraq that actually could be a number of headlines in the U.S. press, but it has not been. It's various election problems in the run-up to the election in January. Pre-election violence is on the rise. Three bombings happened in Shiite holy cities in the last 2 weeks, the cities of Karbala and Najaf, which is, a signal of inter-ethnic or inter-religious violence to come. There have been the assassination of election workers in Baghdad, probably also in other cities we haven't been able to hear about because reporters don't get outside of Baghdad much.
Bombings of voter registration centers.
Mm-hmm. A number of the food distribution centers, which are supposed to be handing out voter registration forms to people who are coming to collect food distributions, they have refused to pass out voter registration forms because they have received threats from insurgents. They don't want their food distribution center to be bombed, and so they are not participating in the voter registration process. That is a problem, and that is occurring even in some neighborhoods in Baghdad. The warehouse, the main warehouse in the city of Mosul, which is the third largest city in Iraq, that held all of the city's voter registration forms, so voter registration forms for every household in the city, that warehouse was looted and burned during the violence that erupted in response to the U.S. invasion of Fallujah. So those folks won't get a chance to register to vote. Many Shiites, there are many Shiites on the candidate list, but very few Sunnis. That's the problem. The most popular party to submit a list of candidates is dominated by Shiite religious groups, the two groups, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawah Party, both of them pretty much religious-based and have ties to Iran. Now, a few Iraqis as well are knowledgeable about the upcoming election. Most Iraqis think, when they're asked by reporters, that the vote is to choose a president, when in fact it's a vote to choose candidates to sit on a 275-seat assembly, which will draft the permanent constitution and oversee national elections by December 2005. That is, they're going to elect the real interim government, as opposed to the interim government, which they have right now. Now, the ballot will be very confusing. There are no legislative districts. Everybody in the country will be voting on every candidate on the list. That's some 6,400 candidates from 66 different parties. And you thought the California governor's race was bad. That's going to be wild. And there's still the government, the interim government is still trying to decide how they're going to print the ballots for this and how they're going to present this to voters. So these are all problems that have not been in the news here. You'd have to go to the British press to read about them, or the French press agency, or you can read them from the Associated Press Newswire or the Reuters Newswire, but you're not going to see this in your local paper. This is all stuff that we could stand to hear about, because it very directly affects the deployment of American troops in Iraq. So with that in mind, that's our list of who gets lumps of coal for Christmas this year.
All right. Well, one of the things we do regularly here on the radio version of Eat the State each year, and you doing your print version, is kind of rate stories for both overhyped and underreported each year.
Yeah.
So, and with the remaining time we got, maybe we can talk about some of those overhyped stories.
Well, there were a number of them this year, because they had to fill the airtime with something. You know, 24/7 air news cycles, and they don't give us very much real news, so they have to give us something else instead. And there were an awful lot of them. The whole storyline of John Kerry as a viable candidate, and we'll go through these relatively quickly because we don't have a whole lot of time left today. But and you can read the descriptions of all of these are in the print version of Eat the State that's out this week. But the whole idea that John Kerry was elected as the Democratic nominee because he was the person who could beat George Bush, and then he ran in this incredibly anemic campaign all the way through September. And that probably cost him the election. So that storyline was, at the best, highly overrated. The idea of Ralph Nader as a threat to the Democratic ticket, again, you know, who are they kidding? I mean, it was just kind of a preposterous idea all the way along. We had the whole the economy is improving, then it's not, then it is, then it's not, then it is, then it's not. But Alan Greenspan says.
Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, and the stories would flip-flop from day to day. You open the newspaper one day, and it's, the economy's improving. You open the paper the next day, unemployment's up. You know, it was just wild. And it's really a reflection of wishful thinking. We want the economy to get better. Wall Street wants the economy to get better, but it's not happening.
Lies, damn lies, and statistics.
That's right.
You get enough statistics, you can extract almost something positive out of almost any of them. So we had then the Scott Peterson trial, which probably doesn't need any further elaboration because it's already gotten plenty. We had the death of Ronald Reagan, which was not so much overhyped as very much selectively reported, that there were any number of aspects of Reagan's legacy, not just as president, but also of governor of California and throughout his entire career, that were not reported at the time of his death. You know, the Iran-Contra, the illegal wars in Central America, the record number of indictments of his various cabinet officials, the savings and loan scandal that started on his watch. The AIDS, the homelessness, the me decade. You could just go on and on.
Yeah, the dismantling of social welfare programs. I mean, it just goes on and on and on.
And none of that was reported at the time of
his
death.
Union busting goes on.
Yeah, PATCO. I mean, it was just he was a really nice guy, and he single-handedly ended communism, which one was not particularly relevant, and the other is just not true. So we then had a couple of categories of terms that simply don't carry much much meaning.
Yeah, weapons of mass destruction, that overused term you hear in almost every single foreign policy speech George Bush gives. You know, it's a justification for everything. It's been used so much it no longer has any meaning, and it should be retired permanently from the English language.
Yeah, and, now, and foreign terrorists you could put in the same category.
Yes, foreign terrorists should also be retired as well, because it obviously has no meaning anymore, since that's the catch-all term for the guys we're fighting against in Iraq, when it's quite obvious there are very few, if any, foreign terrorists in Iraq. We're fighting Iraqis.
Yeah. And at that same level, almost anything that you could say about the White House says about Iraq, you can put in the category of overhype, because there's such rose-colored scenarios and such so fundamentally out of tune with that, what's actually happening on the ground in Iraq, and what's happening on the ground in Iraq is one of the underreported stories.
Yeah. A good example of that anything that the administration says about Iraq is hype is when Iraq was invaded last spring in April 2003, the military was saying, well, we'll be out of the country by December 2004. Well, here we are. It's December 2004, and we are no closer to leaving the country. In fact, there are more troops there than have been in the past year and in the run-up to the Iraqi elections, and it's an open question as to whether the elections will even take place. So that's a good example of the hype that comes out of the White House and the Pentagon's news spin.
Yeah, and you know, you get these repeated phrases in Bush's speeches to the effect of freedom is on the march and so forth, and it's like, who are they kidding?
And so, what does that mean?
Yeah, what exactly does that mean? And we'll stop there.
I think if I was going to go anywhere with freedom, it'd be dancing somewhere with freedom rather than marching with a gun in my hand, you know?
Yeah. One last that I want to mention is extreme weather hype, which is, you know, something that we make fun of regularly on this show. The, you know, Storm Watch 2004, big west gust of wind 2004. At the same time, you know, with global climate change, which is another one of the underreported stories, this is something that's going to happen. You know, this is something we're going to have to get used to.
Well, and it's interesting because we report on the big gust of wind here locally, but we never hear about the enormous floods that killed, you know, thousands of people on the other side of the world, or the heat wave that killed tens of thousands of people in Europe. You know, those are not big news headlines, and yet a lot, you know, hours of airtime is spent talking about the possibility that it might snow in your local area. I mean, that's insane. It is absolutely insane that they don't discuss the real weather problems, the global climate change, global warming, that sort of thing, and really tell you why it is that people are worried about weather now, and why when we do experience weather, it's more extreme than we expected and than it's been in the past.
So anyway, all of those are listed at the in the latest Eat the State issue, which is at the website,
www. Well, it will be at the website soon. It's not there yet.
It's not there yet, but it will be. www.eatthestate.org. And once again, you can also send donations there. It accepts PayPal, and you could also send to the P.O. Box, which I promise I'd mention again, which is P.O. Box 85541, Seattle, Washington, 98145.
All right. Did you give the phone number in there too?
No, I did not. I was going
waiting for me to cue you up on that.
Yeah, basically.
Talking once again with John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, co-editors of Eat the State, and you kind of already gave the info on where people can send for Eat the State. But what's the phone number?
The phone number, and you can find the paper also at bookstores and cafes and places like that where you find free papers. The phone number is area code 206-903-9461, and we accept volunteers and people who want to help out too. It's always something we can need.
Yeah, still looking for more people to distribute.
Yes, very, very much so. Yes. We had John Foss, who's one of our yeoman distributors, who's been out with some health problems the last couple of months, and we're scrambling to try and replace some of his routes. So,
okay, all right. So, and you'll both be back next week, right?
Yes, we will. New Year's Day.
Very good.
We're gonna have a wild New Year's Eve celebration. I can already tell.
All right.